Okay, so we'll go ahead and get started. So good morning. My name is Lynn Yao. I am with the Food and Drug Administration. The session this morning is entitled Informed Use of Medicines in Children and Pregnant Women, Overcoming the Challenges. The goal of today's session is to provide you some information and updates on what FDA is doing in the world of children, pregnant women, and lactating women, and overcoming some of the challenges that we have related to getting safe and effective drugs for these populations. I want to make a point that, this meeting is really, it's the first time I've been to this meeting, and it really is an incredible collection of folks who are interested in promoting and maintaining the public health of Americans. And one of the challenges that I see, in the coming together of all these different disciplines, all promoting, again, and looking into challenges in public health, we at the FDA also provide sort of one arm, if you will, of the governmental oversight of public health. And at FDA, we spend a lot of time working with companies, sponsors, and within the context of the laws and regulations that we have to work under to provide, again, the safest and most effective drugs for pregnant women, lactating women, and children. So I hope this session today will provide some insights on what we're doing and some of the new initiatives that we have related to that. So our first speaker, as you see, we have three speakers, and the program actually, unfortunately, didn't list all the speakers that we have, but I think that we'll give you some very interesting insights today. Our first speaker is Rosemary Addy, who is a regulatory health project manager with the Division of Pediatric and Maternal Health staff. She's been at FDA since 2002, has been instrumental, really, at the forefront of implementing several pieces of legislation that have led to the improved labeling that we see for drugs as they relate to children, the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act and the Pediatric Research Equity Act. She's been a lead project manager on our team since August of 2008. So I'd like to introduce Rosemary now.
Good morning. Good morning. First of all, I'd like to apologize for my voice, though I think everybody can hear me, but one of my colleagues said to me on Friday, they said, Rosemary, you were supposed to kiss the frog, not swallow it. So if you have any difficulty hearing me, just let me know. I'll wave your hand and I'll try to speak up. I have no financial relationships to disclose. The opinions I express in this presentation are those of myself and do not necessarily reflect the positions or policy of the FDA. This morning I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of pediatric drug development in the U.S. and the current tools. I'm going to spend most of my time on the current tools that FDA uses for labeling drugs in pediatrics, and I'm going to also talk about some of the successes that we've had. This is some of the acronyms that I'll be using during my talk. We at FDA have our own alphabet soup, so if you are not sure what I'm talking about, I'll be happy to clarify that. So throughout history, many of the tragedies that have occurred with medications occurred in children. These tragedies often resulted in new laws and regulations, but testing was still done primarily in adults. The first pediatric regulation went into effect in 1979. Over the years, we've seen much-needed protections for children come into effect. So where are we today? Today, we primarily use two laws, the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act and the Pediatric Research Equity Act, to ensure that our children are protected during the drug development process. BPCA was first passed in 2002 as an extension of a law that was passed in 1997. PREA was first passed in 2003, and it was intended to codify the provisions of the pediatric rule that had gone into effect in 1998 but was overturned in the courts in 2002. In 2007, both of these laws were reauthorized and expanded. And then just this past July, both of these laws were made permanent, so we no longer have to worry about reauthorization, but we also got additional protections for children with that reauthorization. This chart just shows the different stages of the drug development process. The work we do at FDA occurs primarily from the beginning of phase one throughout the post-marketing phase. So where do pediatrics fit into this process? With the changes to the law under FDASIA, the pediatric study plan, which is required under PREA, must be submitted by the sponsor no later than 60 days after the end of phase two meeting. PREA required studies must be submitted with the NDA. And FDA may request studies under BPCA through a written request anywhere between phase three through the post-marketing period. FDA has three basic tools that we use to get the necessary information in the pediatric population. First, we have required pediatric studies under PREA. Second, we have voluntary pediatric studies that are conducted by the sponsor via an on-patent written request. And third, for older drugs, we have a process where NIH, in collaboration with FDA, contracts with universities or other CROs to have studies conducted. So when is PREA triggered? PREA is triggered any time a sponsor submits a new application for a new active ingredient, for a new indication, for a new dosing regimen, for a new dosage form, or for a new route of administration. Sponsors must submit their studies with their NDA or BLA unless studies are waived or deferred. Because we don't want unnecessary studies conducted in children, the law identifies these four specific reasons that studies may be waived. Sponsors may receive a full waiver of pediatric studies if the necessary studies would be impossible or highly impracticable to conduct in the pediatric population, if there's evidence strongly suggesting that the drug or biologic would be ineffective or unsafe in the pediatric population, or if the drug or biologic does not represent a meaningful therapeutic benefit over existing therapies and would not be likely to use in a substantial number of patients. Sponsors may receive a partial waiver for a particular subset of the pediatric population for any of these reasons, and also if the applicant can demonstrate that reasonable attempts to produce a pediatric formulation that would be necessary for that age group have failed. Studies may also be deferred. It was the intent of Congress that adult approvals not be held up because studies had not been conducted in children. The two most common reasons that we defer studies are because the drug or biologic is ready for approval in adults and pediatric studies have not been completed, or because pediatric studies need to be delayed until we have additional safety and effectiveness data that have been collected in the post-marketing phase. I should have mentioned also that on some of these slides, I'm not going to go over every detail just in the interest of time. So if there's something that I don't go over on the slide and you have questions about that, I'll be happy to answer those questions at the end. With the passage of FDASIA, FDA gained new authority to require sponsors to submit their pediatric study plans no later than 60 days after the end of phase two meeting. We also now have the authority to grant extensions if sponsors are delayed in conducting their pediatric studies, and we also have increased enforcement mechanisms. The pediatric study plan must include an outline of studies to be conducted, and any request for a waiver or partial waiver or deferral, and the justification for the sponsor to receive that waiver or deferral. So what should sponsors consider when developing their pediatric plan? They should plan to provide an overview of the disease in the pediatric population. They should tell us what plans they have, if any, to extrapolate efficacy from the adult population. They should provide any justification for the waiver that they are requesting. They should tell us whether they will need to develop a pediatric-friendly formulation of the product. They should let us know what non-clinical data they have or plan to have to support the studies in children. They should summarize all the clinical studies that they're planning, and they should submit a timeline under which they plan to do the studies. As I've mentioned, the sponsor must submit their pediatric study plan no later than the end of phase two meeting. The FDA then has 90 days to review the plan and meet with the sponsor. Once the sponsor has received our comments, they then have 90 days to submit the agreed pediatric study plan. The FDA, once we receive that agreed pediatric study plan, we have 30 days to review that and to send a letter to the sponsor confirming the agreement. This chart just is a diagram of how that process works. Now on to the deferral extension that I mentioned earlier. Currently, whenever a sponsor does not submit pediatric studies by the deferral date, the only avenue that we have is to list them as being delayed on our website that includes information about all post-marketing requirements, regardless of whether they're for pediatric studies or not. We did not have the authority to change the due date, even if the sponsor had a legitimate reason for being delayed. FDASIA put into place a process that allows sponsors who are delayed to request an extension. It lays out a time frame for all studies that are already past due or will be past due by April 5th, 2013, and also for any studies, for any that are expected to be delayed moving forward. Our general criteria for granting an extension will be if the delay in development could not have been prevented or could not have been foreseen, and if the sponsor will still be able to complete the studies. If the sponsor will not be able to complete the studies, at that point we would consider waiving the pediatric requirement. So moving on to BPCA, under BPCA we are able to issue two types of written requests, one for on-patent drugs and one for off-patent drugs. So what is a written request? It's a legal document that FDA issues to drug sponsors describing the studies we want them to conduct in the pediatric population. For drugs that still have patent or exclusivity, if the sponsor conducts the studies that we request, they can get an additional 6 months of marketing exclusivity. And that marketing exclusivity will apply to all forms of the drug product line. This exclusivity is not a standalone exclusivity. In other words, if they must have an already existing patent or exclusivity in order to receive pediatric exclusivity. This exclusivity doesn't confer to the entire moiety. So if they have several different drug products for that moiety, for instance, with fluticasone, where they have Cutivate, that's for atopic dermatitis, and Flonase, which is for asthma, both of those products would be covered by the pediatric exclusivity if they still have some patent or exclusivity on those products. This is a substantial financial incentive to the sponsors to do the studies, and it does delay introduction of generic products onto the market for another 6 months. For older drugs, excuse me, for older drugs that do not qualify for pediatric exclusivity, we issue a written request to sponsors knowing that they will most likely decline the studies because there is no financial incentive for them to do the studies. Once they decline the studies, NIH then contracts with universities or other CROs to have those studies conducted. Over the last 15 years, we have issued 421 written requests. From those, we have received studies from 209 different moieties, and we have granted pediatric exclusivity for 183 moieties. Under BPCA and the pediatric rule, which preceded PREA, we've been able to add pediatric information to 458 labels. So you can see that these laws have made a big difference in what we know about the use of drugs in children, and has given healthcare providers the confidence to know that they are properly prescribing the use of these drugs in children. Over the years, the changes that have been made to the laws have improved our ability to get information into the pediatric population, out to the public. Since 2007, sponsors have been required to include information from studies conducted under both PREA and BPCA in their label, regardless of whether the product is approved for pediatric use. So that means even if they have negative information from the studies that they did in the pediatric population, that information has to go into the label. And that actually only applies to the pediatric population. Also since 2007, if a sponsor develops a pediatric formulation to conduct studies under BPCA, where they get that financial incentive, if that formulation gains approval and the sponsor fails to market that formulation within 1 year of receiving pediatric exclusivity, we then post that information online on our website. This provision is designed to discourage sponsors from creating a formulation that they know they have no intention of ever marketing, and then gaming the system to keep generics off the market. Since 2007, we have also had the ability to post documentation that a sponsor submits supporting their request for partial waiver because they cannot develop a pediatric formulation. Since that time, no sponsor has actually requested such a waiver, so it would appear that sponsors may be trying harder to develop pediatric formulations for their drugs. For pediatric studies conducted under both BPCA and PREA, we post the full medical, statistical, and clinical pharmacology reviews 30 days after we take an action on the application. So in summary, we've been able to use both BPCA and PREA to get new information into the public domain regarding the use of medications in the pediatric population. This is where you can find us on the web, both the pediatric and maternal health staff and also the Office of Pediatric Therapeutics, which is in the Office of the Commissioner. So they deal with not only drugs and biologics, but they also deal with pediatric issues with food as well, with food and also devices. Does anyone have any questions? Any kind of clarifying questions? We'll also be taking questions at the end, so for the panel. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Rosemary. So next up is another one of my colleagues, Melissa Tessinari, who will be talking to you this morning about medication use in pregnant women and nursing mothers, scientific and regulatory considerations in drug development. Melissa is a senior clinical analyst with pediatric and maternal health staff, and she works closely with all of the panel members as well as myself. Prior to that, she was the senior director of the head of strategic policy management, regulatory policy, and intelligence for Pfizer. So she has both governmental as well as industry experience. She has also, importantly, been the past president of the Teratology Society. So she carries a wealth of experience relating to how we need to consider drugs in pregnant women and nursing mothers. Melissa?
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. So I want to continue our conversation today about, I think, what we all agree are rather special populations. And I also have no financial relationships to disclose, and my opinions here are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of or the policy of the FDA. So as you saw in some of Rosemary's slides, when a new drug is approved, we actually have a fair amount of data on its safety and efficacy that have been obtained through required clinical trials in adults. These data appear in the prescription drug label and enable a considered risk-benefit decision as to whether or not to prescribe that drug for an individual patient. However, when the patient is female and of childbearing age, we are a bit challenged by a data gap for the safe and effective use of that particular drug. That data gap challenges our ability to make good risk-benefit decisions. We also have even greater gaps when it comes to counseling and treating pregnant women and lactating women. So how do we get at that? Well, we get at that usually through work that continues beyond the approval of that drug, through pregnancy registries and other methods, sometimes clinical trials, and sometimes studies during lactation. You're going to hear with our next speaker, Dr. McCune, about some of the innovative ways we are trying to approach and improve the way that we get medicine, get information for those new therapeutics. So first, the definition, just to see where we're headed in this area and this data gap that we have. We consider females of reproductive potential to include girls who have entered puberty and all women who have a uterus and have not passed through menopause. Fundamentally, all females who are able of bearing a child. Now, as I said, the clinical studies in the trials that approve those drugs contain female patients, and we do know a fair amount about all of those. But as you also know, I think that 50% of pregnancies are unplanned, certainly in the United States. And this poses a challenge for women with chronic disease who need to have medicine to stay healthy. What is that woman's option? And can we provide the data that she needs to make her individual risk-benefit decision along with her physician or healthcare provider? Importantly, for females of reproductive potential, we need to offer them the correct advice to make those decisions. So we're talking about effective contraception, how to avoid pregnancy if that is the desire of the woman in that particular time, and we need sufficient data so that she can balance the potential risks to the fetus versus that of taking the medication for her health. These are not small decisions for her to make. So, pregnant women are not a separate and distinct population. They are a very dynamic subset of the adolescent and female populations who use drugs and biologics. Women move in and out of this subset many times in their reproductive lifespan. And this subset have differences that we really have to consider when we enter into that question of whether a drug is going to be prescribed or not. And our challenge is to consider whether and when and how to include pregnant women in this drug development process. While we know a lot about a particular drug, not all of that information can be extrapolated for use in pregnancy. We are challenged to get that data and to better account for the changes in the safety and efficacy profile of that drug due to the physiology of pregnancy. Similarly, we need data for lactating women. We all know the benefits of breastfeeding, and they're clear, certainly, for the 6 months to a year, and that is standard at practice and advocacy. Our gap here is a true lack of information. What is that conversation we're going to have with the woman who wants to breastfeed when she also needs to consider to taking a medication? How much do we know about whether that medication gets into breast milk? And how will we know if that medication, once in the breast milk, affects the breastfeeding child? These are pieces of vital data that we need to try and get. And this absence of information can really deter women from breastfeeding when it might be okay to breastfeed. So we have a real challenge here. So how do we do this? Well, we can try and actively collect data. First thing we're going to do, however, is find where my notes are. We're going to build on what we already know from the drug improvement process in the adult trials, in gaining that information in the pediatric trials, particularly for adolescent girls, as you've just heard from Rosemary, Addie. And we're going to try and build the case and build this information that we can add in. For those of you who may have been able to hear Dr. Rasmussen yesterday, I think it was an elegant description of how you can marry good animal model work with good clinical studies to really get at some of this data that we are missing. Her work on the changes in maternal nutrition and pregnancy outcome and lactation, I think, stand as a good measure for all of us in trying to really understand how we can help women in this subset. To involve pregnant or lactating women in clinical trials or clinical studies, however, really demands a thoughtful and carefully planned process. Who are those people that you want to include, and in what kind of study, and what are the true objectives of that study, and more importantly, can you power that study to get meaningful data to carry forward? So, a couple of the ways that we look at filling this gap, particularly around pregnancy, does occur post-approval or once the drug is out on the market. And we do this in a number of ways. We can actively go out and try and collect that data, either through a prospective approach using a cohort study, and these are the commonly known as the pregnancy registries, which I think you may have seen often with certain of the drugs. Now, these particular prospective studies can focus just on a single drug, or they can focus on multiple drugs in the same class or in the same disease state and allow us to maximize the gain of looking forward. The distinction between having a woman enroll in a prospective cohort study and a retrospective cohort study has to do with when we know about the pregnancy outcome. And if we can enroll a woman in a trial before we know the outcome, then we prospectively look at it. Otherwise, we try and collect that data in a backward-looking fashion, subject to all the standards of bias that we have to account for in understanding the study. To round out the plate, we can certainly look at case control studies, and we certainly have what are probably more passive systems, our pharmacovigilance system, like the adverse events report system, or AERS, which is commonly in place for every marketed and approved drug. We also can take a look at clinical trials. So we all know the pregnant women get sick and sick women get pregnant. And we also know from many studies that, and the percentage can vary, but you know, well over half of pregnant women in the United States take a prescribed medication for which they probably we don't have enough data. And then if you include women who are taking over-the-counter medications, that number gets even higher. And this is not just in the first trimester, but in all the trimesters that we need to remember and focus on. So when we're in positions of having medication and pregnancy in the same space with the same patient, how do we make these decisions to treat or not to treat? And unfortunately, these decisions still are in the absence of all the data that we really would like to have. If you think about now the going directly at some of these questions in clinical trials, there are some important things that we just have as sort of our essential tenets here. Women really should have effective treatment during pregnancy. But you've got to figure out how to balance some of these concerns as we go forward very carefully. There's the maternal safety aspect. Is the treatment or is the lack of treatment going to result in adverse events that compromise maternal health and that pregnancy outcome? Then there's the focus on the fetus. And is the inadequate treatment, is that ill mother going to compromise the fetal well-being? And then there's something called the cost of uncertainty, and I think this is where we really need to focus and address our efforts. There is a great reticence to prescribe needed medications in pregnancy. If there's one message that we have been extraordinarily successful about is if you're pregnant, don't take anything. Well, that's not really true and shouldn't be true, and we have to provide good information so that women can make these choices in a thoughtful manner. And there are huge risks to not treating a woman who is ill when she's pregnant or under-treating that woman who is ill. But there's a big caveat here. This is a highly vulnerable population. We are working and being concerned not about one patient, but two patients. So not all drugs are appropriate for clinical trials. And the decision to include pregnant women in clinical trials is determined by the need and the ability to conduct those trials with minimal risk. So if we have considerations for enrolling pregnant women, there are a couple of circumstances here. If you have a woman who's on a chronic medication already prescribed a drug for therapy reasons, you have a group of patients that potentially are open for study. But there has to be a prospect of direct benefit to that woman. And importantly, you need to know as much as you possibly can before you enter a woman who's pregnant into a trial. And specifically, in the way we're viewing data, we want to make sure that all information that we have from our preclinical animal studies are complete and have given us the best characterization that we can. The other way to get data in pregnancy and looking at drug use is the woman who has, before she's pregnant, enrolled in a clinical trial, and then during the course of that trial becomes pregnant. The question then is, should they be allowed to continue in the study? Well, this again is weighing the benefits of continued treatment against the potential risks of an ongoing fetal exposure where we may or may not have enough information about that particular drug. We have to look at the risks of discontinuing maternal therapy and or the risks of exposing a fetus to a change in medications where we may have even less understanding of what the risks are. If you look at this absence of information that we have for lactation studies, we really are in the same space. We know usually enough about the characteristics of the drug to understand if the drug potentially can be in the breast milk. And we can use that information that we have to understand and verify in clinical lactation studies. And these can take the form either of what we call a milk-only study, which is just the analysis of expressed milk from a woman who is taking a medication and understand the concentration of that particular product in human milk. Or we can extend that to a milk and infant exposure study where we're looking not only at the content of the milk, but we're also looking and trying to calculate the possible infant daily dose in that human milk. These studies are almost always conducted post-approval and are usually part of what we require in our post-marketing study expectations when a drug is approved, if they're needed. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about how we communicate the data when we've got it. In 2006, there was a major change in the way the drug label appears, and it's called the Physician's Labeling Rule, and it applies to all drugs who were approved from mid-2001 forward. So all of those drugs from that time are in this format that was designed to really improve the delivery of the information that we do have. If you look now at a drug label, you'll see that it has a section called highlights. It actually has a table of contents where you can go and find greater detail. But what did not happen in 2006 when this came out was any change or in the portions of the label involved with pregnancy, labor and delivery, or nursing and lactation. You saw the timeline in the previous talk. And in 1979, along with the labeling rule, came pregnancy letter category designations. And these are the A, B, C, D, X that you will see assigned to all drugs. Well, pretty soon and very quickly after that letter category came through, it became clear that there were a lot of shortcomings in just simply assigning a drug a pregnancy category. First off, people saw this as a grading system where there was an increase in risk when you went from A to X. This isn't necessarily the case. The pregnancy category designation is assigned to a drug based on the presence or absence of the animal data and the human data available at the time that drug is given that category. So it's not necessary to have all the data in the space that you want to have it. So this grading system idea didn't really hold. Clinically, just for someone to tell you that the drug has a B or C or a D assignment is not terribly informative when you have a patient sitting in front of you and you need to understand it. It does not convey the characteristics of the reproductive risk that you need to consider. And most importantly, in this current climate, in this current format, human data, when we were able to acquire it, was not easily put into the label, and it's actually quite rare. This is something we're working on. And one of the ways we're working on it is that in 2008, to complete that physician's labeling rule, a proposed pregnancy and lactation labeling rule was issued. And it really is designed to improve the communication of information for that risk-benefit. It rearranges some of the information that was currently in the old label. And most importantly, it does away with the category letters. So going forward, as we look to the finalization of this particular rule, new labels will no longer have an A, B, C, D, or an X. But what it will have is a section of pregnancy that it is designed to specifically deliver the data at hand to, hopefully, in a much more concise manner, deliver the risk information as we know it to make those good decisions. The format that you're going to see in these new labels will include information on a pregnancy registry when one is available. It will have the risk summary statement, which is a concise executive summary, if you will, of the findings of the data that we had. If there are clinical considerations around the disease or the particular event that drug is being treated that's relevant to pregnancy, you're going to find it there. You're going to find also all the human and animal data that's present that will allow you to understand why that risk summary has been made. And the same is going to be true in the lactation section. Now, this slide also probably ought to be considered more as other tools rather than communication options necessarily, but really to round out the approach. When the delivery of this information is sufficient that we really feel that we need more than just the label, you will see accompanying a drug something called a medication guide, which is a handout that is a more complete description of the potential risks and benefits of taking that drug. And if we have severe concerns about a certain risk, there is a product called a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy, which you may have heard of, which is called a REMS. And these are applied when restricted distribution of a drug, say, for example, for thalidomide or isotretinoin, where you really want to be able to more closely control the use of that drug and the care of that drug. So we're in an interesting space for pregnant and lactating women and women and females of childbearing potential. We know these women have to use medication during their pregnancy and lactation. We know we need data to improve that risk benefit for making the health, to improve the health of the mother and reduce the possible risk to the fetus. So we're actively working in many ways as we can to fill that data gap. We need to also, through, for example, the pregnancy labeling rule, deliver that information in an effective way as possible. And these are the challenges that we have and that we are working towards, and we look for all your help to help us achieve going forward. And finally, I'm here today because Lieutenant Commander Sarisa could not be here, and I think it's fairly obvious that we are very excited and awaiting the birth of her twins.
Thank you, Melissa. Does anybody have any questions for Melissa before we move on to our final talk of the morning? Okay. So our final talk of the morning is Developing Therapeutics for Pregnant Women and Neonates, Challenges and Innovation. So what we hope we've done with the first two talks is sort of explain to you what FDA is doing in the world of pediatrics and in the world of maternal health and women who are breastfeeding their children. Now what we'd like to do is talk about some innovative and interesting developments in how we study pregnant women and neonates. And this talk will be given by my colleague Susan McCune. Dr. McCune is the Deputy Director of the Office of Translational Sciences at FDA. She joined the agency in 2003, and at that time, pediatric drug development was in the same office, actually, as the Office of Counterterrorism. So it's a kind of a funny combination, but you'll often see these weird combinations just for the purposes of dividing personnel. But indeed, she was in the Office of Counterterrorism and Pediatric Drug Development. When the offices then split, she joined, she was actually the associate director of the team of the Office of Counterterrorism and Emergency Coordination, and then was promoted to the Office of Translational Sciences as the deputy director. Excuse me. The Office of Translational Sciences is a really exciting and impressive place within FDA, because within the Office of Translational Sciences, you have the Office of Biostatistics, the Office of Clinical Pharmacology, and they also provide oversight in terms of the innovations that are going on in FDA, including the Computational Sciences Center. And OTS is also partnered with the Critical Path Initiatives to help move and push drug development forward. So I will like to invite Susan to the podium now to give her presentation.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Good morning, everyone. Okay, we've been here for about an hour. Everybody stretch. Take a deep breath. I would have you stand up, but I'd be afraid someone would leave. Please don't do that. And I assume everyone can hear me because usually I'm not kind of challenged in that perspective. So I think what you've heard today is really a great background in terms of the regulatory framework for how we can get studies done in pediatrics and in pregnant women. And I think you've heard, you know, some of the challenges and gaps, and there are huge gaps. But I think that maybe with some of the innovative strategies that I'm going to talk about today, there really is a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm a little biased. I'm a neonatologist, so most of my talk will be a little bit more focused on the neonatal aspect as opposed to the pregnant woman. But a lot of the concepts are really very much the same, because everyone says, how can you possibly study that vulnerable population, whether it be pregnant women or whether it be neonates? And my response to that is, well, if you're going to give drugs, which we give a lot of drugs in the neonatal intensive care unit, if you're going to give drugs to that infant and you don't know what you're giving, you're essentially doing a trial of an N of one on that baby without anybody really knowing about it. And so you're not collecting data, you're not benefiting anyone else, and you're really primarily not benefiting the infant that you're treating because you don't necessarily know whether it actually is safe and efficacious. So that being said, I have, as everyone else up here, from an FDA perspective, clearly no financial relationships to disclose, and my opinions are those of me and do not reflect the official positions or policy of the FDA. So I'm going to talk very briefly about the challenges because I think we heard quite a bit about, you know, the challenges, and we do have a lot of challenges. And then I want to talk about some innovative strategies of where we might be able to really narrow the gaps that we've heard about this morning by using strategies like modeling and simulation, by using clinical trial design innovative approaches, by using data standards and taking all the data that we get in multiple different formats and being able to utilize however we get that data, and then consortia efforts because we can't do this alone. And then just a little bit about the future. So as we heard, you know, pregnant women are really two patients. And these two patients have may have competing priorities and needs. Hopefully they have the same, you know, needs. But as we heard, you know, chronic medications affect infants, and also not treating mothers actually affects infants as well. Physiologic changes in pregnancy are amazing, and I don't think we know enough about them. Mary Habert did a wonderful study of anthrax prophylaxis with amoxicillin. Actually, what she did was PK studies of amoxicillin in pregnant women, and then tried to look at how that could potentially be used for anthrax prophylaxis. You're talking about 60 days of prophylaxis in these women. And what she found was, based on the PK data, they would need about a gram of amoxicillin every 4 hours. Now, in terms of drug compliance, we know that most people have trouble doing once a day, a little more trouble twice a day. When you start asking people to do it 6 times a day, you're never going to get anyone to comply, let alone for 60 days. So I think that, but understanding that, I don't know that we ever would have understood that without her doing those kinds of PK studies. And clearly it's tremendously important that we do these studies. We wouldn't know what we know in terms of the benefits of antenatal steroids and antenatal HIV therapy for neonates if we hadn't had the studies. And all of these studies are governed, in essence, by human subjects protections. And for the pregnant women, those are in HHS Regulations 45 CFR Part 46. And I would just say that there is a growing literature out there in terms of the ethical framework for designing and conducting pharmacologic research in pregnant women. But I think this is critically important for us to get this information. Challenges in neonates are that the neonatal diseases are very unique. We are undergoing the ontogeny of organ and enzyme systems, and premature infants just complicate that even further. And then everything that we do in the neonatal period has potential effects on the neurodevelopmental outcome of these infants. And depending on the literature that you read, anywhere between 45 and 90% of the drugs that we use in the NICU are all used off-label. And once again, as a vulnerable population, studies in this population are directed by human subjects protections under HHS regulations 45 CFR subpart D. But once again, there is a growing literature in terms of supporting the study of drugs in newborns. I'm going to go back even further in history. We started in the 2000, went to the 1979, now we're going to go to 1906. Back then, these are two of my favorites. Over here is Peter's specific blood purifier system regulator. Basically, it claimed that it would cure pretty much everything, but it did not list any of its contents, and that was actually quite legal before 1906. Down here, there's my mouse. Down here we have Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup for children and teething, which was really great because since it was laced with morphine, it knocked the kids out and made everybody happy, except for the fact that it killed a lot of infants. So in 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act prohibited interstate commerce in adulterated or misbranded drugs, and that was the beginning of what down here is the mission statement for the FDA in terms of being responsible for protecting the public health by assuring safety, efficacy, and security of human and veterinary drugs, biologic products, medical devices, our nation's food supply, cosmetics, and products that emit irradiation. So as Rosemary showed this process, I just want to take a couple of seconds to walk you through this. This is the pre-discovery period, and over here is the post-marketing surveillance after a drug is on the market, where we're looking out here primarily at safety because in the clinical trials, we generally don't have enough patients to look at very rare safety signals. But if you look at this, the pre-clinical phase is generally around 3 to 6 years. You start with around 5 to 10,000 compounds. By the time you screen through those, you get to about 250. You take about 5 through phase 1, then into phase 2, phase 3. This process that generally involves anywhere from 20 patients up to thousands of patients and can take anywhere from 5 to 10 years winds up with potential for one FDA-approved drug. And as you might imagine, that's a lot of time and a lot of expense, and we need to figure out maybe there's a better way. What we heard this morning from BPCA and PREA is we now have the regulatory framework to actually be able to do studies. And as Rosemary said, we're actually putting information in the label about studies where the drugs are not efficacious. This is a great database. If anybody, if you go to the website that Rosemary gave you this morning, you can actually link to the database. You can look at any of the labels that have been done, pediatric labeling. And I just have two up here, actually two of the neonatal labels. Where's the mouse? There we go. So the first is Prevacid, where it says effectiveness was not established in a 4-week multicenter double-blind placebo-controlled study of patients 1 month and less than 12 months of age. And then the second, little mouse challenge today, I apologize. The second is Recuronium, which actually says that it's not recommended for rapid sequence induction in pediatric patients because the onset of time and clinical duration varied with the dose. So we did studies. We clearly have labeling associated with this, but now we have two drugs that probably aren't good for us to use in the neonatal population, which is good information to know, but we need to have more drugs to move forward. So this is, for those of you that might not be able to see it in the back, this is a little mouse on the psychiatry couch. And the psychiatrist is saying, I believe I have a new approach to psychotherapy, but like everything else, the FDA tells me it first has to be tested in mice. Maybe that's not the way we need to go. So in terms of innovation at the FDA, not necessarily two words that tend to go together. Back in 2006, the Critical Path Opportunities list went through a number of topics from better evaluation tools to harnessing bioinformatics and looking at specific at-risk populations, pediatrics. A new version of innovation at the FDA has come out in October 2011 called Driving Biomedical Innovation Initiatives to Improve Products for Patients. Similar types of issues are still being addressed, but in a more specific language in terms of building infrastructure to drive and support personalized medicine, expediting drug development pathways, and harnessing data mining and information sharing. All of these things are important in the pediatric and pregnant woman studies. I'm going to talk a couple of minutes about modeling and simulation because I think this is critically important to how we move forward, because I think we're getting a lot of information and data and we need to be able to harness this. We're getting information from clinical trials. We know basic science biology. We're learning a lot about drug dosing, about patient characteristics and the results of those responses to those drugs. And what we can do is put those into to biological modeling and then hopefully to approval and labeling decisions. We've been using this, a couple of examples of this. One of them is protopam chloride. The label states that the effectiveness has been extrapolated from the adult population supported by non-clinical studies, pharmacokinetic studies in adults and experience in pediatric population. So using some pediatric PK data as well as efficacy and modeling, we were able to develop a pediatric dose for pralidoxime and then also for levaquin for doses for anthrax. Modeling was used to determine a dosage across the pediatric spectrum. I put this up here. Phenobarbital is not an FDA-approved drug. It's one that we give our neonates very frequently. But I think it's important that we really start to understand a lot of the enzyme systems and the ontogeny of those systems in newborns as well as preterm infants. In adult studies of CYP2C19 polymorphisms associated with phenobarbital, the total clearance was less in poor metabolizers versus extensive metabolizers. And just as a basic view, this data here, looking at across the genotypes, one is concentration and one is clearance. And basically, there are no differences between the CYP polymorphisms in the neonate. So something to consider as we're dosing these medications. Disease models, I think, are critically important. We're learning much more about these disease models, and hopefully we'll be able to use them to try to identify biomarkers that we can then use in clinical trials. This is a disease model of apoptosis, something that's very important in hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. This is one of, there are multiple models online that you can look at. This is one of the KEG models, and this is only a very small part of the apoptotic pathway. But as you can see, there are all these potential steps where we might be able to intervene. So in terms of modeling and simulation, the strengths are that they use limited PK data to optimize doses to be tested, that there's a better understanding of the mechanisms of disease to predict efficacy, safety, and off-target effects, that there's a more precise understanding of neonatal drug metabolism. However, in terms of challenges, we need a lot more basic science information and we need a lot more neonatal-specific disease models. And we need more information on the ontogeny of those enzyme systems to improve the prediction of drug metabolism, especially in neonates. Innovative trial designs, I think, are critically important in this population as well as in rare diseases. We have a number of guidance documents that are either just published in draft or are in development in terms of trial designs themselves, adaptive trial designs, non-inferiority trial designs, multiple endpoint analysis, enrichment designs, and the treatment of missing data. All of these, I think, would be incredibly important in these populations, and then additional topics, including meta-analysis, to be able to use data across multiple trials, and then the qualification process for drug development tools. And I'll spend a couple of minutes on that last one. Drug development tools are
things like biomarkers, clinical outcome assessment tools, and animal models for use under the animal rule. And the concept is that once you qualify a tool within a stated context of use, that measurement, that biomarker measurement, can be relied upon to have a stated interpretation and utility. However, in this case, the context of use needs to be clearly specified and may be related to the population being studied. From a regulatory perspective, industry can then rely on using this biomarker each time that that biomarker is used. It doesn't have to be shown to be efficacious in that particular IND or NDA submission. And these are very important not only for what people think of as endpoints or surrogate endpoints biomarkers, because the bar is very high for those, but predictive and prognostic biomarkers may really help us in the clinical trial design, because they may help us better identify populations that may be more responsive or identify populations that may have increased risk from a safety perspective. In terms of innovative clinical trial designs, the strengths are that we have potentially more efficient clinical trials, that we are able to use drug development tools for more consistent evaluations, and that we have improved ability to define inclusion and exclusion criteria to enhance both safety and efficacy. In terms of the challenges, we need a lot more discussion of adaptive clinical trial designs in neonates. We need to utilize these trial designs across multiple centers, and then we need to develop biomarkers and clinical outcome assessment tools for use in both the neonatal and pregnant populations. I'm going to take a couple of seconds to talk about data. For those of you not from the FDA, I hate this. Oops. Oh, didn't realize I could change slides that way too. Interesting. All right, so on the left side of the slide are the way that we used to get and kind of sometimes still get data, which is a lot of paper. And it's really not very efficient for us to be able to do that. If you look on the right-hand side, one of my favorite examples is this one here. If you're looking, this is actually a trial where a drug was started here. The study drug was started back here. What happened was the LFTs rose here. And without being able to see this from a visual perspective, you wouldn't recognize that actually the rise in LFTs was actually related to acetaminophen exposure and not related to the drug that was under study. So very simple things like that from a graphical perspective can really help in evaluating these drugs under study. Data standards are critically important for us to be able to analyze data from one study to another and from one patient to another. We can't mix Lincoln logs with Legos. We all know about how to send a letter, but if the same data on that envelope were just mixed up, we wouldn't know where to go or where it came from. And that's even true with studies that we have today in terms of male-female. You can call them male-female, you can call them MF, you can call them 1-2, and without any standardization of that data, we can't compare data across trials. So the strengths of data standards are their seamless interoperability between systems and among data sets. There's an increase in data that then is available for analyses, and then we can actually use those analytic tools that I showed you. In terms of challenges, we need to really go paperless. We need to get therapeutic area-based data standards terminology, and we need to develop systems from electronic case reports through sponsored databases to regulatory submissions, and they all have to be interoperable. Optimally, it would be with the electronic healthcare records as well. And we need to develop methods to share data. And finally, from a consortia perspective, we can't do this alone. We need to be able to work with NIH, academia, HMOs, patient organizations, and industry to move innovative drug design forward. There are a number of CDER public-private partnerships that we're involved with. These are only a few examples. The ones at the bottom are all associated with the Critical Path Institute. And then up here, I just wanted to spend a couple of seconds. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Coalition Against Major Diseases Consortium, which is primarily looking at Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients. And then up here, the Pediatric Anesthesia Safety Initiative, which is critically important to the pediatric and neonatal community in terms of looking at the safety of anesthetics. Each of these consortia is driven by the public health concern or public health question that underlies the consortium. As you might imagine, if it's driven by Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, we need new therapies. Industry is very interested in those. From a pediatric anesthesia safety initiative, looking at the safety of anesthetic agents is really driven primarily by the academic community. Just as a model for a consortium, the Critical Path Institute is the third-party convener for the CAMD consortium. Involves on the right-hand side other federal agencies, FDA and NIH, other stakeholders including pharmaceutical companies, professional organizations, patient advocacy groups, academia, and others. They have a number of working groups looking at data, disease modeling, biomarker evaluation, and submissions to the health authorities. So this is an excellent model for all of the innovative strategies that I've talked about before. The strengths of the consortia efforts are that they are collaborative efforts to advance clinical knowledge. They are collaborative approaches in terms of both trial designs and knowledge generation, and they're also developing a number of drug development tools. The challenges are that they need to be established through a neutral third-party convener. They need to reach out to all the stakeholders, and unfortunately in this time we need to identify sources of funding for these consortia efforts. And as multiple consortia are underway, we find that there can be something called consortia fatigue, which we're trying to avoid. So in summary, in essence, we want to be able to take basic science research, understand the pathophysiology of disease and the ontogeny of metabolic pathways, add to those drug development tools like biomarkers and clinical outcome assessments, work with innovative designs in clinical trials, and develop network sites, have interoperable IT systems and standardized data and standardized case report forms, work through public-private partnerships where we have all of the stakeholders involved to improve models to predict dose, to identify populations identify better populations to study, to identify safety and efficacy signals, to have more efficient trials in terms of inclusion and exclusion criteria, and to improve data sharing. And hopefully with all of these approaches, we can have better dosing, more appropriate use of the current drugs that we're using, and increased access to new drugs. With that, this is sometimes how I feel. So we're going to leave the little duck up here because my understanding is that for questions and the recording, we need to leave the slides up. But if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Thanks, Susie. So we hope that with the three presentations we've provided this morning that we've given you a flavor of the types of initiatives and actions that we do every day at FDA to help with the informed use of medications in children, in pregnant women, and in nursing mothers. I think that what you hope if you take away just a few items in terms of the session, that you understand a general role of FDA in, again, promoting the public health, which is one of our main missions, and specifically for us to promote the safe and effective use of drugs in children, pregnant women, and nursing mothers. And that really speaks to making sure that we get appropriate information, that we have adequate information, and that we can communicate that information clearly to the folks who would be using the drugs and the medical professionals who would be prescribing those drugs. So with that, I would like to open it up to any questions that you may have relating to the talks or any specific or general questions you might have relating to the role of FDA in promoting the public health in children and women of reproductive potential. Yes, ma'am.
I saw in the slide that you just said that manipulating money was introduced in May 2008. Is there a reason why that
happened? Right. So I'm just going to repeat the question, and Melissa will come up and answer. So the question is that the pregnancy labeling, lactation labeling rule was again out in 2008, but it hasn't been finalized.
So that's usually greeted with a big smile that you saw from all of us. Like for any rule that is going to be issued and followed, there is a fairly extensive process of first providing a period for commentary, which is what happened when we issued this in May of 2008. We had extraordinary response to it. Since that time, we have been working to adequately address the concerns that were raised in that process of public review. And now we are in the process of taking that information, taking the finalized form of that rule through its final clearance steps. And we are hopeful, we remain hopeful, that this clearance process will wrap up soon and that we actually will have the final rule out. The spirit of what is in the proposed rule, though, is something that we have actively moved forward with the regulatory confines that we have now, because it is so critically important to get that information out and get it out with clarity. And because so many of the product labels are coming in to conform with the actual physician's labeling rule, we are able to participate and ask some good questions about getting that data organized even in advance of having the final rule.
So the question, I'll just repeat, is relating to health literacy and the access to information for patients who have lower health literacy, and are there resources available to help. So I'll say firstly that you have pointed out a very important issue, and that you are sort of at the front lines, if you will. So we hope that prescribers are able to spend the time in the office with their patients to explain fully to them why they're prescribing a medicine for them. And as we all know, because we've all been to the doctor, that oftentimes doesn't really happen. And so what happens is that a patient will go to the pharmacy, pick up a prescription, and ask the pharmacist, who has asked the question, and say, well, what are the risks that I have, and why did my doctor prescribe this, and should I be taking it? All questions that, of course, we'd hope could be answered by the prescriber, but oftentimes the pharmacist, who has, again, great knowledge of the product, also can provide some help there. So the first thing I can tell you that at FDA, our main job is to try, when we get the labeling out and the medications guides out, that we have, particularly for the medication guides, a level that is eighth grade or lower, so that we hope that in the medication guides that folks can take those home and read them, understand them if they have eighth grade or higher education, and then ask their prescriber questions that are related to that. We know that sometimes we miss the mark, even though we have labeling comprehension and social scientists who review that to try and hit that on the mark. And so we have also website available information that we can direct, but oftentimes the very folks who don't have that type of literacy are able to access that kind of information technology. So we are kind of in a bind, and I wouldn't say per se that FDA has a specific role, or at least I'm not aware of one. We can certainly talk to our folks back at FDA to see if there are initiatives. But, you know, you bring up a very important point, and we're really trying hard with the printed materials and trying hard to make sure the prescribers spend the time that they need to inform their patients. But it's a gap, if you will, in terms of getting information out. I mean, I think it's a very valid point. Other questions? Other comments? Yes. Right. So the question is related to the use of really protocol-driven medicine practice, if you will, so that when a child is diagnosed with cancer, oftentimes they're immediately rolled into a clinical trial or registry that tracks and follows that patient and also gets important clinical information relating to the use of whatever drug is under study. So I'll speak from my experience, and then I would allow Susie to answer as well. So the oncology studies in children and the way that they've set up and designed those registries, those study groups, is really the model for how we would study drugs and really, realistically, in all patients, but certainly in all children and in all other subgroups that we would like to study. One recent approval that we had for a drug to treat cystic fibrosis also used registry information and a collaborative effort within the patient community to get that information together. And so I would say that type of model is what we would love to see for all types of therapies that were being used in children, and we would encourage that. It's not always that you have the ground roots or the grassroots support to get that type of information and those types of study groups together, but we, in rare diseases and also in children, have been requesting and pleading and encouraging drug developers to reach out and collect that information systematically. And I'll have Dr. McCune speak to that as well.
Thank you. That was an excellent answer and a fabulous question. And I think you're going to start to see this, especially in the neonatal population. That's my hope in the coming years. I think that the Children's Oncology Group has been a fabulous model for us. There are some caveats to that because it's a well-circumscribed prescriber community. I think we've had more success with the rare diseases because a lot of the patient advocacy groups, a lot of families, especially with pediatric rare diseases, are very involved in the patient advocacy groups, and so it's easier to tap into them for clinical trials. I think the neonatal population is one that is an in-hospital captive audience that I think the NICHD Neonatal Network has done a fabulous job with hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy hypothermia trials. They're actually maximizing the hypothermia, both the length and depth of hypothermia right now for hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, and we're hoping that subsequent add-on therapies can be utilized in the same format in terms of using, I believe they're an 18 center network now. Be great if we had larger networks to be able to do this, and I think the consortia base is one that can be used to drive those kinds of efforts. But you're absolutely right. It has to be a concerted effort for everyone to come together in terms of protocol design. Sometimes that's difficult in the practicing community to get everyone to agree to some of the components. But I think we're on the cusp of being able to use some of the things that I talked about in terms of moving forward. I think the pregnant population is a little more challenging because I think it's harder to kind of get a community to be able to have everyone involved in those kinds of trials. But I think that the OBGYN community is really pushing, I think, more for understanding, you know, drugs that are being used in the population as well. So I think this is something that we'll see much more in the future.
I got three answers off this question. So just to add sort of one final note about this and really sort of drive home the point that this has got to be a group effort. When you look from the perspective of drug development, one of the things that I think you saw in Rosemary's talk, and it's one of the mantras that we have, when we work closely, by necessity of what we do, we work closely with the pharmaceutical industry, is to do whatever we can to ensure that the planning for acquiring the information we need in these populations occurs in drug development as early as we can possibly have it happen, because this is the only way that we're going to get the needed data as quickly as possible. Our new regulations in the pediatrics have really advanced that for us, because now when a drug is under development and we have the initial phases of the studies that tell us that this drug is efficacious and probably will be able to become approved, that's when we're asking, well, what about kids? What about the use of this drug potentially not only for the child who might have that same disease that we're studying in the adults, or because of its mechanism of action, might have use in some other pediatric space? We're going to ask that question now. What are you going to do? Those pediatric study plans are going to come in. Similarly, we're beginning to ask the same question about pregnancy. Are the women who are with this disease that we're trying to treat, are they going to become pregnant? What are we going to do about them? What do we need to know in order to not be in the same position we were in with amoxicillin and being totally surprised? So we're really, you know, we're trying to do as much as we can to integrate the thinking, the planning, as early as possible. The other aspect of this comes from my time in this arena, and that is we are facing a crisis of education. We don't have the training programs established to have the people who have the background and information to integrate this and to get this data moving forward in sufficient numbers, and I truly am concerned about this. We have maternal and fetal medicine folks, perinatal folks who really understand this area. We have pediatricians, but we don't have them trained to do these clinical trials. We have clinical pharmacologists who don't have the pediatric expertise that we need. So we need to look in as many possible ways is to get that training and that passion forward into the next group of people that are going to come along and really make this happen.
Any other questions or comments? We have just a few more minutes. Okay, if not, I'd like to thank my speakers this morning, Rosemary Addy, Melissa Tassinari, and Susan McCune, and thank you for your attention.